Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Andrew Solomon, spent 10 years of his life interviewing parents of children of many colors, children who are deaf, children who are dwarfs, children who are prodigies, children who are criminals, children who are suffering from schizophrenia. And he has written a book that's been receiving absolutely rave reviews. It is a very compelling book, and it is titled Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew is also the author of another book you may have read, his 2001 book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and has been published in 24 languages. And I guess you could say, we'll ask him this, but I think that if he were not gay and had not struggled with that as a young person, and it was a very difficult struggle, perhaps this book never would have been written. Andrew has won 14 national awards, including the 2001 National Book Award. He's a New York Times bestseller. He's published in many languages. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University and a special advisor on LGBT affairs to Yale University's Department of Psychiatry. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, is talk@wpr.org. I guess we should also say, important to this discussion, is that Andrew is also a parent, and we'll talk about that as the interview progresses. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us.
What a pleasure to be here.
Oh, a pleasure to have you with us. It is such a compelling book. And why don't we start? You start with your experience in a family that was not very accepting of your being gay, and you knew you were from a very early age. And I was really struck, Andrew, that it wasn't that long ago that you suffered incredible discrimination. I mean, the world has changed some, not a whole lot, but it has changed since when you were a child, hasn't it?
Oh, I think it has changed a whole lot. I mean, there's a long, long way still to go. But the life that I have now with a husband who comes from Wisconsin, by the way.
Oh, he comes from Wisconsin.
He does indeed.
Hey.
And kids, and living an open life in New York in which we're warmly invited everywhere together. It was unimaginable when I was growing up. And part of the motive for the book was really to understand how did we get from a point when homosexuality was considered an illness and a crime and a sin in pretty much all of the United States, to the point at which we have a president who's come out in favor of gay marriage. And if gay people could make that progress, then who else might be able to make a similar kind of progress?
Mm-hmm. Tell me about your parents. Did they realize that you were gay at a young age? Did they try to change you? Were they accepting of you? Was it hard?
You know, I think that they didn't necessarily quite put together the sentence that, you know, I was actually gay, but they definitely saw signs that I was unconventional and different and not conforming to some of the gender norms of my age. So I told the story in the introduction to the book about the time that we were at a shoe store when I was a kid, and the person at the shoe store at the end of our getting our shoes offered my brother and me each a balloon. And my brother got a red balloon. And I said I wanted a pink balloon. And my mother said, no, Andrew, you really want a blue balloon. And I said, no, I really want the pink balloon. I was only six at the time. My mother said, but remember that your favorite color is blue. And as I observed in the book, the fact that my favorite color now actually is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence both of my mom's influence and its limitations. I feel like that partly they were uncomfortable with the idea of my being different themselves, and partly they thought it was going to be a very difficult life for me, and they wanted to protect me. And it wasn't always possible to sort out what was about them and what was about me.
And it was a difficult life. You didn't, until you realized that it was your identity you were trying to traverse, two worlds, that this whole world of wanting to have children, of dating women, but really not wanting to be dating women because you couldn't identify yourself as a gay man until you were older.
Right. And that was a great difficulty for me. I felt as though I had to make this choice, which seemed to me like a terrible, terrible choice. Either I was going to be true to who I really was, and I was going to be gay, and I was going to be with people I actually was physically attracted to and so on, or I could have a family. And I desperately wanted to have a family. I thought it would be the most fulfilling experience there could be in life, and it was one that had a lot of meaning for me. And at the time that I was growing up, there was no way to do both. And I struggled endlessly trying to figure out which was more important to me. And then while I was in the middle of that struggle, the world changed, and it turned out you could do both.
Mm. And we'll save the story of your family because, wow, do you ever have a family, sir, till the end of this hour. It's extraordinary. You start the book with, and it seems as though you have a special affinity for people who are deaf. I believe you were to write an article for the New York Times and you immersed yourself in deaf identity. And I had no idea of the history of teaching deaf people and deaf families and deaf children in this country and what was best for deaf people until I read your chapter. It's been such a struggle for people who are deaf.
It's been a huge struggle. And what happened essentially is that deaf culture began to develop in this country. Before I worked on the article, I had no idea there was any such thing as deaf culture, but actually deafness represents for many deaf people a linguistic subculture in which people are united by their use of sign language. Then Alexander Graham Bell at the end of the 19th century, who had both a deaf mother and a deaf wife, became very involved in the movement to ban sign language and to insist on teaching deaf people to do lip reading and oral speech. And there are some deaf people who are good at lip reading and oral speech and some who aren't. And what he did effectively was to consign many of those who aren't to growing up without any real use of language or any real ability to communicate. And then starting in the 60s, there was the rebirth of a deaf cultural movement in which people said, no, our language is sign language and it's a valid language and we have a valid life and you may see us as deficient, but we see ourselves as no more deficient than people whose primary language is Japanese, even though they live in the United States. And we're perfectly willing to do some lip reading and some oral speech for those of us who want to, but we don't want it to be required of us. And there was the emergence of this deaf culture. And when I went off to study deaf culture, I went in very skeptical. I said, for heaven's sakes, I mean, why would anyone not want to hear such an incredibly vital, useful part of everyone's daily lives? And then when I went out into the deaf world, I thought, okay, this isn't my culture. But it's very convincing as a culture. I went to the Miss Deaf America contest. I saw performances of deaf poetry. I went to the deaf theater. I went to the National Association of the Deaf meetings. I went to deaf clubs. I went to all of these things. And I thought, okay, this really is a culture. And it's really quite a vital culture. And it's quite an attractive culture in a lot of ways. And I can see how, if it were the culture I was part of, I would be very proud of it and very attached to it.
Mm.
And I thought, so how do you reconcile our experience of deafness as a deficit with these people's experience of deafness as a culture?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me to bear a lot of close parallels to the experience of gay people who had at that point largely been told as they were growing up the same way that most deaf people, mostly born to hearing parents, had been told as they were growing up that what they had was a deficit that had to be dealt with. And then in adolescence, suddenly you discover a whole world of people who are like you, and you think, wait a minute, this isn't a deficit, this is who I am, this is a culture, this is me. And I thought that the deaf experience and the gay experience had a lot of parallels, and that was the beginning of a rethinking of the whole world for me, when I thought, okay, there are lots of these conditions that people have that they don't share with their parents, that they are told by their parents are deficits, and that they ultimately come to experience as cultures. It was a revelation.
I was wondering why people could, and these are people who are smart people. Alexander Graham Bell was no dummy. Thomas Edison, who signed on to this, was no dummy as well. How could so many people be so wrong about what was best for children?
You know, it's a very complicated and extremely interesting question. At the most basic level, I think it wasn't possible to know how wrong those ideas were until they'd been put into practice for quite an extended period of time, and until it had become clear how damaging they were for many people. I also think that social standards have changed, and that we used to have a society that was very unaccepting of all difference. It was unaccepting of deafness, it was unaccepting of gayness, it was unaccepting of all kinds of things. I could go on listing them until the end of the hour. And we've had a real sea change in our society in which we've come to value diversity and difference instead of trying to insist that everyone conform to a standard mold and arguing that that's the only real basis for happiness and contentment. But I think in terms of the actual damage that was done after Alexander Graham Bell and so on signed on, I just think it was unknowable how much damage there would be until the damage was manifest. And then at a certain point, everyone could look at it and say, this has been a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the chapter on you begin, I think, when you went to the convention, the dwarf convention. You know what I love about the book is that you think about all this and you spent 10 years with all of these people that we know are there. But I was amazed how much I learned in your book about what people do to try to make people taller and how dwarfs deal with each other and the boyfriends and girlfriends that they can have during the dwarf convention that they can have for a week they may not have for a year because there aren't other people who are dwarfs. I mean, it really opens your eyes to this world that exists, but we just don't pay much attention to it, do we?
We really don't. And that was why, as I got into each of these separate subcultures, I had that moment of truth of thinking, wow, here's another one. Here's another whole right. other world that's existed right along in the middle of our world and that I never saw at all. My experience at the Dwarf Convention was really very inspiring. I met a lot of amazing people. I came to understand, I mean, you mentioned the issue of cure and treatment. And one of the arguments that's central to the book is that we need to sort out, in the first place, what can be cured and what can't be cured, and also what it's desirable to cure and what it's not so desirable to cure. So at the same moment that deaf culture, as I've just described, was emerging as a real cultural force, that was the exact moment when the cochlear implant was being developed, which would eventually make it possible largely to eliminate deafness from the larger society. Mm-hmm. And I said it was a little like those tragic opera plots in which in the final scene, you know, the hero realizes he loves the heroine right as she expires on the couch. And that you've got this sense all the time of the cure, the medical mm-hmm. work toward a cure, and the social work toward a culture being in conflict with one another. And I don't come down in favor of one or the other. I mean, I think if my children had been born deaf, I probably would have wanted to seek a cochlear implant because I think it's an easier and richer life if you have access to hearing, but I would have done it with a lot of ambivalence. Mm. Among dwarfs, however, there's actually just in the last 6 months been work on a pharmacological treatment that may alter the activity of the genes that cause the most common form of dwarfism. There has in general been only limb lengthening, which is a process in which the bones are broken in many places in the lower leg, and they're gradually pulled apart by screws that are inserted through the flesh of the leg, and as they begin to knit together, they're pulled apart again, and eventually you can, by doing this over and over again, you can add as much as 18 inches to someone's height. It makes an enormous difference in that person's height, but you do it at the cost of having the person go through this agonizing treatment, which frequently causes neurological deficits and which lasts for years and years through their sort of essential growth period, the point at which they're forming identity. And so I think if I had a child who's a dwarf, I would not consider limb lengthening. But I recognize that in a previous era, it would have seemed absolutely necessary and natural to do the limb lengthening, just as to me it seems to make some sense to use cochlear implants. My argument is that what seems urgent and appropriate and what seems bizarre and abusive is in a state of constant flux, mm-hmm. and the answers that we have this year are really different from the ones we would have had 25 years ago and are doubtless really different from the ones we will have in 25 years, though who knows what those will be.
And Andrew, what was the experience like? I know that you write about several of these people. For some of the dwarfs that you write about to attend their first dwarf convention?
You know, I think it was an overwhelming experience for many of them. I mean, I remember the first day that I arrived at my first dwarf convention. I never thought I would hear myself saying that, but there it is. Right. That's what I'm saying. The first day that I arrived at my first dwarf convention, I remember meeting someone who was crying, and she seemed to be beside herself, and I said, well, what is it? What's wrong? She said, you don't understand. She said, this is what I look like. I've never understood it before, and now I do. And I felt, being at the first one of these that I went to, I thought, you know, if I see someone who's a dwarf by himself, and dwarfism is a low-frequency disability, and that therefore is not something that you, you know, see all over the place. You're so struck by the fact that you're seeing a dwarf that you almost don't notice anything else about that person. And when I got to the dwarf conference, I suddenly saw, hey, that dwarf over there is really quite beautiful. Mm-hmm. That one seems to have an incredibly animated, fun sense of things and to be having a great time. And that one looks anxious and depressed. And, you know, they all emerged as individuals, as people, when they were all together in a way that it was much harder for them to do when they were one at a time.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for Andrew. We have so much to talk about with this book that is just, it's very long and it's just very, very, very interesting. Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew Solomon spent 10 years interviewing children who were deaf, dwarfs, Down syndrome, autism, schizophrenia, multiple severe disabilities, also children who are prodigies, children who are conceived in rape, which is a very interesting chapter, those who become criminals, transgender, and that's what this book is about, but it's about so much more than that. He takes on, you know, the issues of parenting and parents who can't muster the strength that it takes to parent some of those children. Most parents, however, can. He looks at society's response to some of these children and whether or not, considering advancements in having children, whether or not we should be able to choose to not have children who have certain disabilities. And what will happen, as has happened with gay people in this country, what will happen with people who are deaf, with people who are dwarfs? Will they move into a life where they feel much more comfortable being alive and everybody's much more comfortable with all of those people? The mystifying chapters were the ones of criminality. Those are the one, and I want to talk to Andrew about that. He spent time living, actually, with Tom and Sue Klebold, the parents of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the young people at the Columbine massacre, who did the shooting. All right, so we'll be with you in a moment. Plus, we have to talk about Andrew's incredible family. A lot on the table here. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Andrew Solomon, author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is our guest this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go to Brad for our first caller. Hello, Brad.
Oh, hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that Johnny Carson had a quote decades ago. He said, in America, a man is his job. That is his identity. And I think that's very true. Even till this day in America, and that when people become disabled or incur chronic illness, they oftentimes lose their career or are fired, and it's a real hit to their identity. And I think it's really important that we in our government and our politicians strive to try and embrace diversity, which does include disability and chronic illness, not just race or gender or sexual identity, and try and make some accommodations to help those people use their talents and to be productive, because it's so important to a person's identity that they have a sense of purpose. And in America, that means a job. And I'd like the guests to comment on that a little bit.
Thank you, Brad.
Well, I think there's no question that profession is a huge source of identity. And what I really try to discuss and to study in the book is the way that various kinds of identity overlap. So I have an identity as a New Yorker, as an American citizen, as a person who's 49 years old. As, I mean, there are dozens of identities. Work, I think, is a very central one. To the larger proposal that you made, I think it's incredibly important that we provide jobs programs for people with disabilities. I think it's important for several reasons, one of which is that I think it gives those people a sense of purpose and focus and identity. The other is that I think many people who've got disabilities still have a great deal to contribute, and in marginalizing people or pushing them out to the edges or pushing them out of the workplace, we fail to exploit their skills, their abilities, their resources, and we impoverish not only them but also ourselves when we do so.
Mm.
The place where the biggest argument has gone on, of course, is around education. And I came out of this a firm believer in inclusion, not only because I think it's good for disabled people to spend some time in a classroom with non-disabled kids, but also because I think it's good for those non-disabled kids to engage with some disabled people as human beings and to understand their underlying humanity.
And you had some cases, maybe it was in the Dwarf chapter, maybe elsewhere, where it took a lot of bravery for these young people who had to address classes so they wouldn't be bullied, they wouldn't be stared at. They had to explain, you know, I'm Sarah, I'm 5 years old, I'm a dwarf, and this is who I am, this is my condition. It was quite something for people to confront that directly with other children.
I saw that with dwarfs, but I also saw it with people with Down syndrome, for example. I saw it with people who had a variety of physical and intellectual challenges. I mean, I saw it in adulthood, people who have schizophrenia and who've ended up kind of bravely coming out and saying, I now have treatment and I'm now doing very well, but this is what it's like to have a schizophrenic episode and this is the experience that I've had and these are the ways in which I can engage with the world. It's a lifetime's project, explaining yourself over and over and over again to a society which is not necessarily prepared for the ways in which you're different or the things that are specific to your experience.
Yeah. Thank you, Brad. Let's go to the chapter on prodigies, which I found just fascinating. I wondered why most of them are musical prodigies and why it is that so many, it's usually one parent who sacrifices his or her own life, own imagination because of the imagination and the talents of the children that they are working with. It's such a Why are they all so musical? What is it about the piano, Andrew?
Well, I should say that there are prodigies also in mathematics and to some degree in athletics and in various other fields. I focused on musical prodigies because I'm better qualified to talk about music than I am about astrophysics or about some of these other things. But they tend to be a relatively narrow range of fields in which this kind of prodigy ability emerges. I mean, you don't have a prodigy novelist who at the age of six is writing novels that anyone would want to read. And they tend to be areas in which you can succeed by having a combination of extraordinary technical mastery and the ability to imitate what others are doing. So a seven-year-old pianist, by and large, it's extraordinary that he is able to control his hands well enough to move them across the piano and produce the music he produces, but also extraordinary that his listening to other people has allowed him to create a sort of expressive musical idiom that he uses. And I was really blown away by the skill and talent of some of these prodigies, by the uncanny nature of it. But I was also blown away by the fact that a lot of these people show early skill, which is not the same thing as showing enormous skill, and that there's a difficult path between being unbelievable for a six-year-old and being genuinely an amazing musician by the standards of the adult world.
Were a lot of parents happy to have their children on stage, wanted them to show off, or did an equal number want to try to give them some kind of normal childhood and hide them from a spotlight?
You know, I encountered parents who were in both situations. I encountered some who I thought were really pushing their kids into being more performative and doing more than the kids wanted to do, and others who I thought were really holding their kids back. And I ended up thinking that you could make a mistake in either direction. I was thinking of the woman who said to me, I'd gone to interview her with her son, who was seven and was having an international concert career, which seemed kind of crazy to me. And I said, do you worry about giving him a normal childhood? And he said, well, come on up to my room. You can see I have a normal childhood. We went up to his room. He showed me his favorite cartoons. I saw that he had a bunch of Sesame Street videos lined up next to the TV. And then he said, okay, let's go downstairs and I'll play you the Chopin Fantasy Impromptu. We went downstairs and he played it so beautifully and with such adult yearning. And at the end of playing it, his mother turned to me and said, you see, he's not a normal child. Why should he have a normal childhood? And I thought there was some insight in that. I said, okay, you could try to give this kid as normal a childhood as you could, but the things he's thinking about are very different from the things most kids are thinking about, and there's a limit to how much you can really push him into some idea of normality.
Yeah, that's quite. And it's also something how we are fascinated by children like that, aren't we? If you have a prodigy, you've got a ready-made audience.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes that ready-made audience actually allows the child to express himself and is really great. And sometimes it's a lot of people gawking at someone who's freakish, and in the end it can be very damaging.
Mm-hmm.
But what I really found, and what unites that chapter with the rest of the book, is that the difficult thing is having a child who's different from you in some way. And having a child who's different but very talented is not that much easier than having a child who's different but very disabled.
Mm.
And I ended up thinking, okay, in the same way that it's difficult to have the body of a 30-year-old with the mind of a 4-year-old, it's difficult to have the body of a 4-year-old with the mind of a 30-year-old. In either case, you're missing peers. You don't have a lot of people who are having the same experience you have, and it can be very isolating, and it takes a lot of skill for parents to navigate it.
Yes. At one point, one of the parents says, "My imagination was often replaced by his." And it got me wondering, Andrew, with all of the parents of these children with all kinds of ways of life, how often were the lives of their children the focus of their lives, so that their imagination, their lives, really replaced the parents' own lives because of the demands?
You know, I was very struck when I got to the chapter on schizophrenia, when I was interviewing the mother of someone who has one child who's an extremely successful novelist and another child who's permanently under care because of the extreme nature and untreatability of his schizophrenia.
Mm.
And I said to her toward the end of the interview, she's this rather elegant woman, and I said, "How much of your emotional energy does the issue with your son actually occupy?" She'd been very reserved and very poised through the whole thing, and she suddenly began to cry, and she said, "All of it."
Hmm.
And then she said, she sounded almost guilty about it. She said, I try to focus on other things, but really all of it, she said, "I just can't help it." And that was the experience, I think, of many of these people, that they had these children who were different in some way and required enormous focus and energy for them to be able to pull these children through. Many of them did it. Many of them did amazing jobs. And they also, I mean, they had other children. They took care of their other children and so on. But to do any of these things right, to deal with children altogether will take over your life, even if your children are completely healthy and well. Once you have children, they become awfully central and awfully vocal to your experience. But to deal with these children who are different in some way takes five times as much focus and attention.
And what was the consensus among the parents? Was that okay? Did they feel robbed of their own thoughts, their own time?
Some of them felt robbed and angry and resentful. Some of them felt, you know, that they loved their children and that this was what they were open to and willing to do. A lot of them initially felt utterly overwhelmed and thought, "I didn't want a child with these disabilities. This isn't what I had in mind. I never wanted for this to happen." And then over time, they came to feel that it was actually a very rich and meaningful experience. So I think of Tom and Karen Robards, who have a son with Down syndrome, and I said, who's now in his mid-20s, and I said to them when I interviewed them, "You ended up becoming activists for Down syndrome. You ended up getting involved in reforming the way that people with Down syndrome are educated. Do you wish it hadn't happened? Do you wish you'd never heard of Down syndrome? Do you wish your son didn't have it?" And his parents said, his father first and then his mother. So the father said, "Well, you know, for David, I wish he didn't have it, because for David, it's such a difficult way to be in the world." He said, "But I think I've learned a lot from it." And his mother said, "Yes," she said, "for David, I would cure it in an instant because I would like to make his life as easy as possible. But speaking for myself, though I would never have believed 26 years ago when he was born that I would say this, speaking for myself, it's been such a rich experience that I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world. It's made me a better person than I would have been without it."
Oh, what a remarkable statement.
Yeah, and I found that often, that even if people didn't say it that clearly, that over time they came to find meaning in their experience.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the chapter where it's hard to find meaning, and it's a chapter, this whole experience mystified you. I know you've been interviewed about Newtown, and you're mystified by that. You spent time, and actually you lived in his former room. Tom and Sue Klebold, whose son Dylan committed horrors at Columbine, and you came to know his parents pretty deeply, and the more deeply you knew them, the more mystified you became. This is a really tough one, because people do look at parents and say, "You must have known in some way that your child was deeply disturbed."
And I think that children can be very good at keeping secrets, and that people don't always know. And I also think that whether they know or not, and I think they often don't know, they're also not responsible for it. I mean, we used to say that gayness was caused by overbearing mothers and passive fathers, and that autism was caused by refrigerator mothers, and that schizophrenia was caused by parents who nurtured an unconscious wish that their child not exist. And if you go back 150 more years, the dwarfism and deformity were caused by the unexpressed lascivious longings of the mother that were then revealed in the deformity of their children. And we've had this thing of blaming parents for everything that seems to go back time out of mind. And actually, we've gradually said, oh, no, it turns out that isn't caused by... Oh, look, that isn't caused by parents either.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly parents who exacerbate their children's criminal tendencies through abuse or neglect. But the idea that parents universally are responsible if they have children who commit crimes is very naive.
So tell me about your experience living with Tom and Sue, what they said about their son.
Well, I'll tell you two sort of little anecdotes that to me rather sum it up. I took a long time for me to convince them to do interviews.
Mm.
And then they finally agreed that I could come out and spend a weekend. And once we started talking, it became clear how full they were of their story and how much pain they had to express. And at the end of this weekend of very intensive interviewing, I said to them, well, if Dylan were here now, is there anything you'd want to ask him? And his father said, there sure is. I'd want to ask him what the hell he thought he was doing.
Hmm.
And his mother looked at the floor, and she thought for a minute, and then she looked back up and she said, I would ask him to forgive me for being his mother and never knowing what was going on inside his head.
Hmm.
It was quite an extraordinary moment. And it was about 5 years later that I was having dinner with Sue in Colorado, and she said, you know, I used to think to myself, oh, if I hadn't gone to Ohio State, I'd never have met Tom, and all these terrible things wouldn't have happened, and that would be better. She said, but I've decided that the love for my children, even at the price of this pain, has actually been the greatest thing that there has been in my life, and I don't want to imagine a life without them. She said, so while I know that it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided it would not have been better for me.
Oof.
Yeah.
It's hard to take that one in, isn't it, Andrew?
It is. It and, I mean, she had a kind of Shakespearean or even out of a sort of Greek tragedy quality of, you know, she was so articulate. She had been so mortified and pained by the loss of her own child and by the injury he'd done to those other children. You know, I kept saying around the Newtown thing, you think that the children who were murdered, that their parents suffered more loss than the parent of the murderer somehow suffered less because the parents of the murderer had lost a person who was not of value because he was murderous.
Mm-hmm.
The parents of the murderer or the family of the murderer or the people around the murderer have lost not only the person himself who died in Columbine in Newtown, they've also lost whatever their image was of that person as an essentially good person, and that's a catastrophic and very difficult loss.
Yeah. You also spent time in juvenile detention with juvenile criminals, and I'm wondering if you can give us any kind of deep lessons that you learned about how good can come from bad, if there are any lessons there.
Well, first of all, I was really surprised when I worked in a juvenile facility in Minnesota for a while at how attached I got to be to a lot of the people who were there, and I ended up pulling back from the idea I'd grown up with, which is that there's such a thing as good and such a thing as evil, and there are people who are good and people who are... And I ended up thinking, right, these people did terrible things, and they're deeply flawed, but they're also, in some instances, people with many attractive and appealing qualities, and you have to experience them whole as complete human beings. But I also thought that we have, at the moment, a criminal justice system which is very focused on... retribution, which is very focused on punishing people who committed crimes because it makes the people who are victims of those crimes feel better. And actually, we don't have as much of a focus as we need to have on rehabilitation. And what I found was that a lot of these kids had had a lot of traumatic experience of one kind and another. Some of them were unfixable. They had criminal tendencies that were going to drive them their whole lives. And others, actually, with a lot of counseling, could really come to new insights and could turn themselves around. And I thought we need to have a system in which we give these kids a chance to be turned around. Because even if we only succeed 25% of the time, the savings to us in the costs that are created by crime, in the costs that are created by keeping someone in prison for most of his life, the savings to us are enormous, both the psychic and the economic ones.
We will pause for just a moment and return. This may be the kind of conversation that you're just listening to, but I know there are people listening who are being touched very directly by what Andrew is talking about. You've raised children who may be in one of the chapters in this book, or you are one of the people who are in this book, and you have things to say about your identity, your culture. Andrew spent 10 years interviewing parents and children. Most people share some traits with their parents. He calls these vertical identities, but there's also another kind of identity, a horizontal identity, and he focuses on that. People who may tend to identify with a peer group rather than with their parents. And they're people that we think of some as very unusual, people who are dwarfs, people with criminal backgrounds, people with schizophrenia, multiple disabilities. We have yet to talk about raising a child who is a product of rape. He has written an extremely compelling book in which he looks at the essence of who we are. And what it is we share, and what we don't share, and how we become more tolerant. And that's what we're talking about this hour. So here's our phone number. If you want to join our conversation, I don't want to pressure you, but feel free to call 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's an email that's come in, Andrew. Jamie Lynn emailed to say, my daughter was born with a partial, I don't even know how to pronounce this, trisomy, is it, of the 16th chromosome. It would take a whole hour to explain all the specifics, but her disorder has left her overall physically and mentally delayed. She will require care for the rest of her life and will never be able to live on her own. I find myself to this day having difficulty navigating life with her. She turns 11 in February. Her father and I separated 5 years ago. I have since remarried. I don't plan on having any more children. I'm certainly going to seek out Mr. Solomon's book. I find myself having feelings of isolation, regret, and even jealousy that my daughter wasn't born normal, and those feelings are hard to say out loud.
Well, I think that a lot of the argument of the book is that you have these two things that can exist side by side, one of which is that you can ultimately find a lot of meaning and sometimes even joy in the experience of children who appear from the outside not to invite those responses. But the other is that these are difficult, difficult lives, and that dealing with children like this is an overwhelming experience and responsibility. And a lot of the time, it seemed as though people felt there was a kind of politically correct pressure to say, oh no, I've found meaning in this, it's all great, and you can find meaning in it and still struggle with it. And you can struggle with it and still sometimes find meaning in it. And I would never want to trivialize the experiences that these families have, which are experiences of a deep and profound struggle.
Susan in Madison, hi.
Good morning. I don't really know where to start. I started, ironically, reading your book yesterday, and I just can't thank you enough for it. I had to race through it and almost let you show. I actually have experiences with my three children in four of the chapters. One of my sons has Asperger's, as I found out my husband and my father have. Highly hereditary. While it's a wonderfully fun, quirky attribute, it also has a darker side. I think parenthood, it really shows it very well, although both parents are completely functional, so that's a little different in my case. My daughter, for the longest time, she was lesbian, and most recently she told me that she's transgender, which I just felt bad she hadn't told me sooner, and anyway, your chapter on that was so helpful and the most helpful of anything I've been reading. And then my other son began as a prodigy, musical and otherwise, And while it's wonderful, the, you know, as you were saying, the challenges and the effect on the other children are tremendous, and so it's a double-edged sword. And the saddest part is he developed into, I don't know if it developed into it, but for whatever reason, he did become schizophrenic. Mm. And that, there's no comparison in my mind between the other attributes or identities. They're just fine. They're, you know, they're challenging, but it's nothing like losing a child to that. Mm. And I did want to ask about marijuana, because it seemed to me when he started smoking marijuana, there was just a radical change. And I have read articles that seem to be reputable academic articles about a possible connection. And it terrifies me to think, as we are legalizing it, and I'm from the old days when I didn't think it was very, you know, just better than alcohol. I now see it's changed. It's very potent. And for that 10% of people that might have an underlying predisposition to schizophrenia, there seems to be a possibility that it may trigger it. And do you have any opinion about that? And he committed suicide, so it's not going to help him.
Oh, but, Susan.
Yeah.
Wow, what a life you've had, and what a set of experiences. I mean, first of all, my hat is just off to you for being able to be with your children through all of that.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your book. I'm telling you, I just couldn't read it fast enough, and I downloaded it on my Nook, and then, you know, I got to page 178, so I'm going to keep at it.
I agree with you that schizophrenia is a much greater challenge than a lot of the other issues that we're talking about and that we're contemplating. And as far as your specific question about marijuana use and schizophrenia, the data is somewhat confused and the studies are somewhat imperfect, but the position that I ultimately came to from talking to a variety of doctors is that while most schizophrenia is not caused by the use of marijuana and most marijuana use is not linked to, you know, does not lead to the development of schizophrenia, it seems likely that there is a small group of people who have a particular vulnerability to schizophrenia in whom that vulnerability is activated by extensive use of marijuana. And I think that the long-term effects of extensive marijuana use are not so great. The biggest study was one that was done in the Swedish Army, in which they showed that the chance of developing schizophrenia among recruits who had used marijuana more than 25 times was much higher than the likelihood of developing schizophrenia for people who had used marijuana one time or less. Now, that being said, it's not always clear what's cause and effect, so it may be that people who have a tendency toward schizophrenia are actually drawn to, for some reason, the use of marijuana because it calms them or it stills some of the anxiety that they're experiencing. So we don't have there's not a clear direction in it. But I do think that there appears to be some kind of a link and that it needs to be explored further. Mm.
Yeah, well, again, thank you so much for your book. I really, it also, I mean, there is such a tremendous amount of guilt, and what if I did this, and, you know, so many competing things about nature versus nurture, and it's just an overwhelming amount of guilt, and your book really is sent so kindly towards the parents, and I appreciate it a lot.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You. Bye.
Well, that's a meaningful call for you, Andrew, I'm sure.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about issues such as transgender. I feel like it's absolutely true. There are some of these things in which the issue primarily is getting used to it, accepting it, and finding an identity community around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other areas, like schizophrenia, where the illness, so there are many people I met who have schizophrenia that's been responsive to treatment and who are doing incredibly well, but for many people, it's a devastating diagnosis and it doesn't have much of an upside.
Yeah. Thank you, Susan, for the call. An email from Amy. I opened first to the chapter on children born of rape. I applaud your research and talking with people about all angles of the issue and after effects. I finished the chapter saying every politician should be required to read this. Can you comment on how that chapter has been received? It makes the point that the decision to have a child is deeply personal, with layers and layers of relationship dynamics, both inter and intrapersonal.
I think the decision to have a the decision to have a child is always a very complicated decision. I'm not sure I quite understood what the question is.
How it's been, well, let's just take, how has it been received? People don't write about this very often. I must say I haven't read any studies of this. It was very personal. It was interesting to read the decision that was made by women in this chapter, and why they made such a decision.
The problem has been, I think, that a lot of the writing, which is about people having children following rape, choosing to keep those children, has been sort of co-opted by the arguments about choice by both sides.
Yes.
That there are people who feel like it somehow, you know, because there's so much argument about the rape exception in abortion laws and so on, the people who are in favor of keeping the right to abortion tend to argue that people with rape can never really want to have these children. People who are strongly opposed to abortion rights for women generally are arguing a lot of the time that parents who choose to abort these children are actually snuffing out valuable lives, and that the people who keep the children have a wonderful experience. And I found the reality was someplace in between, which is that many of these people chose to keep their children for religious reasons, because of the laws in the states where they were, for a whole variety of other reasons. And many of them ultimately were able to develop good relationships with their children, but that it was unbelievably hard. Mm-hmm. And I didn't meet anyone who had kept a child under these circumstances who hadn't struggled quite a lot with both the decision to do so and the experience of having a child who, every time she saw that child, reminded her of the terrible trauma she'd been through. And I really wanted to try to tell the stories of these women and say, look, this is very, very hard, but sometimes can be ultimately rewarding. And what is the balanced middle approach here, which is not agenda-driven in either direction?
Right. All right, we've reached the point in time where we get to talk about your extraordinary family. And you finally got to be a dad. Did you ever get to be a dad? How's it going?
I absolutely love it. It's been the greatest experience of my life. Yes, my husband from Wisconsin is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. Then one of my closest friends from college had been through a difficult divorce and said that she had always dreamed of being a mother, and I offered to be the father of her child. And so we have a daughter who lives with her mother in Texas. And then my husband and I have a son, George, who lives with us all the time. And the surrogate who carried that pregnancy for us, I'm the biological father, and the surrogate who carried the pregnancy was Laura, one of the lesbian mothers of the children in Minneapolis. So my shorthand is five parents of four kids in three states.
Oh, yeah, isn't that something? I mean, you never would have imagined that when you were a kid, you know, singing the opera on the school bus.
In a million years. And even when I knew the college friend who I described, who was extremely beautiful and popular, and I thought if someone had said to me, one day you'll have a daughter with your friend Blaine, I would have said, oh, come on, don't be ridiculous. But life takes very strange twists and turns, and these are the ones that's taken for me.
Yeah, and for all of the people in your book. Are you surprised? I mean, there's so much in this book, isn't there, Andrew, in so many ways, including a good chunk of your life?
Yes, well, it was an 11-year project to write, and I ended up talking to over 300 families, and it was a long and intense process, but but, you know, a lot of people said to me, they said, it's extraordinary that you decided to have a family while you were in the middle of writing this book, because that's, in fact, what happened. They said, it's a book about everything that can go wrong. I would have thought it would scare you off. And I said, actually, it's not a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how resilient families can be, mm-hmm. even when everything is going wrong. And I thought, if all of these people can manage to love all of these children, mm-hmm. then I think I'm going to do fine with whatever children I have. And I think it helped really give me the conviction that I needed to go forward and have a family in this unorthodox way. And as I say, doing so has proved to be, for me, a great joy. The day our son was born, the day after he was born, they thought briefly that he had possible brain damage. We had to do a lot of scans, and I suddenly saw myself headed in an alarming way right into this world that I'd been writing about. And I thought, okay, I don't want my child to have brain damage, and I'm frightened of what might happen. But at the same time, I didn't feel scared of it in the way that I would have before I read the book.
Andrew, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the book. It's wonderful. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It's been a huge pleasure.
Andrew Solomon, the book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program, and thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll be with you. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again on Monday, All Things Political at 9 o'clock.